attended a meeting of EU health ministers on Tuesday.
My main messages today: continue, vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. The difficulties that some member states are currently facing with COVID-19 cases at record high and extreme pressure on hospitals is a stark reminder of this.
Critics say EU health authorities are putting the bloc's vaccination strategy in peril by not giving a clear message on the benefit of booster vaccines. For example, here is what the European Medicines Agency has been saying.
So it's not a strong recommendation as sometimes we do when we really see the need of a booster in the overall population.
The Eurozone economy is already at breaking point due to the pandemic. A conference in Brussels has been discussing the growing problem of long-term unemployment.
It's like a car. If you let a car that is not used for many time in your garage, in your storage, it doesn't work like before. But it doesn't mean that it cannot be recovered at the full of their potential. But this is the responsibility of the government on that.
Gas and electricity prices are soaring in the 19-nation Eurozone, adding to economic uncertainty. But gas and electricity costs aren't the only concerns.
Oil, but also other commodities, and certain commodities like metal need a lot of energy to be produced, so there's a direct link.
And there is a direct link between health and the economy. At their meeting, EU ministers pledged to donate 500 million COVID-19 vaccines to less well-off countries before the middle of next year. Aid agencies insist the EU has a moral duty to keep this promise. Health authorities and economists say the move is in the bloc's own interest in the context of trying to prevent the virus from mutating. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
With Lebanon plunging into darkness as two main power stations barely function, Hezbollah Secretary General called on the government to bring on a complete solution to electricity blackouts.
We need to have a drastic solution to the electricity issue, build new power plants, solve the problems in the current power plants. There are several proposals on the table from various countries in the East and the West. If you don't want from the East, then take proposals of the Western countries. Unless there is an American veto and the Americans are prohibiting you. Tell that to the Lebanese people honestly.
Nasrallah uncovered that the Lebanese government has even turned down offers from countries like Germany and France for fear of U.S. sanctions. He urged the Lebanese government to seek a waiver.
There is a new proposal given by Iran's foreign minister in Beirut a couple of days ago. He said Iran is ready to build two power plants and provide a very good amount of fuel. Give him an answer. Seek a sanctions waiver. For us, the U.S. is an enemy. We can expect anything from an enemy, but if you consider it a friend and a confidant, then fine. Ask this beloved friend, whom you believe has humanity, to make an exception like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Small businesses have been struggling and say they are experiencing what they call a slow death to make ends meet. What this man used to do using electricity, he is now doing with his own hands.
We used to see the electricity for 30 minutes or so, but now nothing. This area used to be a busy area. Now all the work and shops have shut down. Electricity is everything in my work. Now I'm working manually using a saw. I even stopped a private generator because I can't afford it.
Those who can afford it are turning to private generators. Rabia is the owner of one of the private generators south of Beirut. Before the import of Iranian fuel, the bill cost a fortune.
We suffered so much before, especially when we had to raise prices. It's always the people who have to pay the heavy price because of the black market. We thank God and we thank Syed Hassan and the Islamic Republic who launched this initiative and saved us from the dark and saved the people from paying a very high bill.
Al Amana Petroleum is selling the Iranian diesel for almost half the official price with the subsidies lifted. While the leader of the resistance did declare that Hezbollah will be donating and selling Iranian fuel for the second month, he also stressed that this is only a temporary solution.
On top of the socio-economic crisis in Lebanon lies an almost total collapse of the electricity crisis. Hezbollah's Secretary General has called on the government to prioritize the issue in order to put the country on the track of a drastic solution. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's major nuclear facilities have been targeted by cruise missiles. Iranian air defense says it has successfully foiled the attack using homegrown missile systems. This is the scenario for a massive military drill held over a 500,000 square kilometer area in central Iran, codenamed Defenders of Velayat Skies. The air defense exercise engaged the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division.
In these drills, we have simulated real-life war scenarios where the enemy uses manned and unmanned aircraft as well as cruise missiles to attack our sensitive facilities. And air defense units will use indigenously built defense systems to counter the hostile force.
These military exercises are held as part of our annual routine drills. They are not a threat to any country and are aimed at boosting our deterrence and increasing our preparedness against any potential hostile move.
The air drill involved the latest military equipment developed by Iranian experts, including missile systems, drones, and radars. Iranian military officials boast the country's capabilities in indigenizing the defense industry and say they owe this to the long-running U.S. arms embargoes.
We have gone through decades of sanctions imposed against our defense sector. But we prove that if we discover our domestic capacities, we will definitely be able to build up our defense arsenal and protect our sovereignty using our know-how. I should say that in this maneuver, all of the equipment are made inside Iran.
The annual maneuver started on Tuesday and will continue until Wednesday. Military officials here say, given the recent developments in Iran's eastern and northwestern borders, there's a need to boost coordination and synergy between the Iranian army and the IRGC to counter any potential threats. They say these drills can help achieve such a goal. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
After taking power, the Taliban leaders reached to the Shia community seeking their support and allegiance. The Taliban officials said their government will include all Afghans and social justice will be protected.
Today's Shia people are safer than before. We don't let any individual hurt you. You are from Afghanistan and have equal rights. The Islamic Emirate recognizes you as part of Afghan society.
The Shia Ulama Council at a press conference on August 24 urged the Taliban to ensure that they will treat all faiths and ethnicities with equality and justice.
War is hard.
We are happy that U.S. forces have left our country. Congratulations to the Afghan nation. In the meantime, we demand and recommend that the Taliban fulfill their promises by forming an all-inclusive government.
During weeks under the Taliban rule, many people from the Shia community have reportedly been displaced in Dikandi and some were massacred by the Taliban in Ghazni and Dikandi, Amnesty International confirms. At the same time, the Daesh still takes lives from the community. Nearly 300 Shia worshippers were killed and wounded in Kunduz blast on Friday. Following this tragic event, Shia Clerics Council in Afghanistan once again urged the Taliban to investigate the deadly attack and take massacre of Shia seriously, as well as call for unity among all Muslims.
Shias are making 20% of the population of Afghanistan. The Taliban can't establish an inclusive Islamic government without giving equal role to us. We also condemn the catastrophic attack in Kunduz and urge the Taliban to bring its perpetrators to justice.
After taking power, the Taliban promised the formation of an inclusive government and providing a safe ground for all Afghans. But Shia minority is concerned that the threat of Daesh terrorist group is being ignored by the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Another deadly day for Shia worshippers in Afghanistan. At least 41 people are killed and dozens more injured after three back-to-back explosions hit a mosque in the city of Kandahar. According to a Taliban official, initial information suggests the attack was carried out by a suicide bomber. Taliban have so far failed to stop such attacks after they rose to power a few months ago. At the same time, there are warnings, including one by the Russian President Vladimir Putin. The battle-hardened militants and terrorists with Daesh links are actively entering Afghanistan from Iraq and Syria. In tonight's spotlight, we will discuss the situation in Afghanistan and the growing attacks by Daesh in the war-ravaged country and their implications for Afghanistan and for the region. Stay tuned.
The United States invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of eliminating Al-Qaeda terrorists who were being supported by the then Taliban government. Washington spent $2 trillion in maintaining its military presence, but at a heavy human cost. Over 6,000 Americans and more than 100,000 Afghans were killed and millions of others displaced. But the U.S. never achieved its stated goals. Rather, fled from Afghanistan, leaving the country again in the hands of the Taliban. Now the Taliban are facing a multitude of challenges. One of the main tasks before the group is how to fix the economy, as nearly half of the population is in need of foreign assistance. Humanitarian organizations have already warned that the country is on the brink of collapse. But perhaps a more pressing issue is security. Although Afghanistan has witnessed sectarian violence for decades, deadly incidents have increased since a Daesh terror group emerged in the country at the height of the U.S. military campaign. The Taliban have failed to put an end to such carnages after they rose to power in the war-ravaged country a few months ago. Last Friday, more than 100 worshippers were killed or wounded in a Daesh-claimed attack on a Shia congregation mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. The tragedy struck again on October 15th, this time in Kandahar, where a series of explosions inside a Shia mosque left dozens of worshippers dead. Some analysts believe the United States is trying to sow the seed of sectarian strife, since an unstable Afghanistan serves Washington's interests.
Certainly, there are a number of national interests, both near and afar, that seem almost hell-bent on maintaining a state of insecurity and conflict throughout the Middle East, all the way over, certainly to Afghanistan. Certainly the U.S. Policy going back many years, going back 20 years now at least, has always been to encourage conflict in the region and maintain a state of instability. It suits Israel. It suits a number of other parties.
And it's clear that somebody is trying to provoke a sectarian war between the Shias and the Sunnis. Who's going to benefit from that is, I think, the ultimate question. In Iraq, for example, there's evidence that the British, Americans, and the Israelis were setting off bombs to try to provoke a conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, so it's easier to control. Perhaps that same tactic is being employed in Afghanistan, where you have, you know, British and American, you know, agents trying to provoke a civil war to pit the Sunni and the Shia and then to help destabilize the country. And out of that, they might be able to get some sort of control.
No matter who are the perpetrators of sectarian violence in Afghanistan, one thing is for certain. The Taliban, as new rulers, need to ensure security for all ethnic and religious groups. Otherwise, neither the international community nor the Afghan people will ever see them fit to govern, and thus will continue losing their credibility.
Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, joining us from Washington, D.C. Also on the panel, we have journalist and political commentator Ramiro Funes joining us from Los Angeles.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Springman in Washington. If you may, please share with us your views on the recent violence that has unfolded in Kandahar.
Well, the recent violence is, of course, deplorable, and it's far more deplorable because it's something that I think you can tie directly to the United States and its left-behind forces. While the American Army may have been formally withdrawn, you still have this Central Intelligence Agency paramilitaries, their own clandestine service people and their agents there. You've got American mercenaries still there, I would believe. So I think what they're trying to do, as some of your commentary came in earlier, is basically to keep Afghanistan totally destabilized and to ensure that the country will never recover from the 20 years of American invasion and occupation. You've got a new government trying to gain control of the country or regain control of the country. And the Taliban are being cut off from foreign aid. The Americans are holding millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, in Afghan funds, as are the Europeans. The United States has directed the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank not to provide any monies whatsoever in any kind of way of supporting the new government in Afghanistan. And as long as you can show that these people are not in control of the country, that cannot control and secure the lives and safety of the inhabitants, they want to show that this is a failure and the Americans need to come back in. The Washington Post for the last several weeks has been running articles about the terrible state of women, the terrible segregation in Afghanistan, the terrible this, the terrible that, as a justification for bringing the Americans back to regain control of the country and supposedly ensure that there will be peace and order again, as if there were during the 20 years of American occupation. Additionally, I would say that they're pushing the idea of the split between the Sunni and the Shi. This may have been an issue 1,000 years ago when Islam developed its two branches, but I think today the Americans and the Europeans and the apartheid entity that calls itself Israel are simply out to show there is a big split in Islam, and that the Sunni are our wonderful friends and the Shi are dangerous, destabilizing forces. And naturally, of course, the Americans are in control of all of this. They created Islamic terrorism with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan 20 years ago, if not longer. Then they created a new variety called Al-Qaeda, which is basically the same crowd with a different name. And now it's Daesh, or Islamic State, or IS, or whatever you want to call it. But in reality, it's the same crowd we created and trained and supported with the help of the Saudis and the Pakistanis in the 1980s and 1990s and so forth.
Mr. Funes, on October 13th, to be precise, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned that militants with Daesh links are actively being drawn from Iraq and Syria into Afghanistan. Putin said, and I quote him, "It's possible the terrorists may try to destabilize the situation in neighboring states," warning that they could even try direct expansion. Who do you think is transferring these terrorists to Afghanistan, and what is the goal behind their deployment?
First of all, I want to offer my condolences to our fallen sisters and brothers in Afghanistan, of course, in Kandahar, but also in Kunduz, where there was also an attack against a Shia mosque. This some community is reeling and is devastated by the impacts of terrorism backed by imperialism and capitalism and Zionism. We have to keep our eyes on the prize. We have to keep in mind who is moving these militants from Syria to Afghanistan, who is funding the rise of these radical Wahhab. It's Israel, it is the United States, it is them, because they are able to use them as proxies for their imperialist regime change against the Islamic Republic of Iran, the People's Republic of China, against the Russian Federation, as Putin was pointing out as well. This is part of the new strategy of regime change, which is chaos, destruction. It used to be that the imperialists would go into a country and have some sort of attempt to rebuild it. That's no longer the case. From destruction, this is accumulation of profits through destruction. And by creating chaos in Afghanistan, by sowing the seeds of division, of backing groups like ISIS-K and attacking Shia Muslims, they're trying to gain this divide and conquer strategy that we've seen carried out in Lebanon, we've seen carried out in Syria, we've seen carried out in Yemen. And at the end of the day, the main enemy of people, the Muslim world, the Islamic world, is not the Shias, it's not the Sunnis, it's not the main enemy is imperialism. And as long as we keep that in mind, that is the most important. And I think that, as the other guests correctly mentioned, the same forces that backed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 70s, the same forces that supported al-Nusra and all these other groups in Syria, the so-called pro-democracy protests in Syria, these are all the same NGOs, the same corporations, the same lobbies connected to Israel, the United Kingdom, the United States, that are fomenting this violence and destruction in order for them to justify a new regime change effort, a new platform and base of destabilization in the region. So this is what it all forms part of.
Mr. Springman, I saw you nodding there. You can add anything if you'd like to what our guest Mr. Funes was mentioning. Also, another question. Observers, there are a number of observers, actually, who believe in an existing level of coordination between elements of the United States with Daesh. How do you feel about that notion?
Well, Mr. Funes's remarks were right on the money. As far as your question about the U.S. connection with Daesh, I'd say they are very close. The United States created them, as I noted earlier in my book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts to Rock the World. I traced the development and the name changes and brand changes, if you will, of Islamic terrorism. And it's basically the Americans and their reprehensible and repulsive allies, such as the apartheid entity, which styles itself Israel, along with Saudi Arabia, a very repulsive and repressive monarchy, are deeply involved in all of this. And they see this as a way of keeping the area destabilized to ensure that the American government can justify its occupation of Syria, its occupation of Iraq, and its constant attacks on Iran in concert with the apartheid entity of Israel. So I think that it is a very conscious thing. It isn't a casual contact the United States has with Daesh or any of these other terrorist organizations like the Khorasan people. It's basically let's keep the destabilization rolling and hope that it spills over into Iran and keeps Iraq and Syria from becoming real independent countries. We did this in Yugoslavia and broke it up into small statelets. The United States has split the north off from Iraq. The United States wants to totally destroy Iran, and the United States wants to keep Afghanistan in pieces. 20 years of occupation and war on a country that where the average wage or income is $2 a day for 90% of the population is a guarantee for destabilization and future problems, and guarantee that the legitimate government of Iran, run by the Taliban, will not be able to take over and control the country and bring peace and order to the place.
Right. Mr. Funes, the same goes certain level of collusion for figures from probably the previous government in Afghanistan, the deposed Ashraf Ghani government, of having Daesh being in collusion with them. What do you think about that?
It's no surprise that Ashraf Ghani and his cabinet, backed by the United States, was collaborating with ISIS-K and these other groups. Because at the end of the day, what his administration represented was a kinder and gentler face of U.S. imperialism, of destabilization. His role, he was sort of like the good cop in the good cop, bad cop scenario. He presented a democratic front, a rebranding, if you will, of Afghanistan, even though these still extremist elements were operating in the country under U.S. occupation, receiving training. The Saudis and the Gulf monarchies have been boosting and expanding their funding for madrasas and other institutions in Afghanistan under this administration. So while he's not openly, his government was not openly supporting ISIS-K and the Wahhabi Daesh elements, at the same time, they were allowing for that to grow, to continue to persist under the country. And I think one of the ways that we can describe it is sort of a controlled demolition, right? He was there allowing all of these groups to expand, bringing the development of Afghanistan to a very minimal, low point, so that instead of people having good jobs and education and trade and with other countries, their only option was to get involved in these groups and to become radicalized. So in a way, he kind of provided cover for ISIS-K and other extremist groups in the country and in the region so that they can grow and build dual power, so that for the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion occupation, his government would leave, the U.S. would leave, groups like ISIS-K would gain so much power, and then they can once again use that as a justification for invasion.
Mr. Springman, let's focus yet again on the bigger picture and the ripple effects and ramifications for the region. A civil war or any form of civil conflict in Afghanistan would have such dire consequences, as there are so many different ethnic groups. Let's not forget the devastation that that country has endured, having been through decades of war, well over four decades of war. Who would benefit from such instability and violence? And also, what were the repercussions would it have in the broader region and for countries neighboring Afghanistan?
Well, the United States, the Israeli entity, and the European countries to the United States, like Britain, benefit. They can sell weapons. They can political influence. They can ensure that the and remains in pieces and cannot be. There are 14 their ethnic groups speaking languages in the country, plus half minority language. The idea of divide and rule, empire, is exactly. This is what the Americans and their they can ensure that if it is in pieces, the force is easily free into neighboring territory and ensure that they be able to function.
Some technical difficulties with your connection. I'm going to jump in there. Let's bring a question to Mr. Funia as well. My guys sort that out for you, Mr. Funes. Let's talk about, at this point, you know, we can't talk about Afghanistan without considering the U.S.-led occupation of the country and the tragic events that took place following the pullout of the foreign forces. In your opinion, what did the U.S. achieve during its two decades of presence in Afghanistan?
In the two decades of U.S. occupation in Afghanistan, the big winners were the drug companies. We know, for example, there's a very wealthy, powerful family in the United States named the Sackler family, big supporters of Israel who are involved in the production and sale of a drug named OxyContin, which in the United States is a massive problem, opioid addiction. In cities across the U.S. where deindustrialization has taken place, you have families who have been impacted by opioid addiction. Drug companies have been making money, tons of profits and money. And it's interesting that this happens just as the U.S. occupies Afghanistan for 20 years. If you look at two charts, one chart, opioid addiction and deaths by year, and also U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, you'll see extreme parallels where opioid companies have raked in millions from the U.S. presence. And some people in mainstream media might critique that, might think that it's crazy, but knowing the history of the U.S. and their involvement in the drug trade, this is definitely something of concern. I think another big winner in the U.S. occupation was the military-industrial complex. Think about all those weapons, machinery, guns, things that are used for killing and destroying people, produced by Raytheon, General Electric. All these companies that run the U.S. government, they made a killing. They made tons of money because of this occupation, that now all those weapons are in the hands of other people. So they also made a ton of money because there's a whole industry in the United States around perpetuating war. Endless war is profitable for the U.S. imperialists. And so this occupation
Sure.
benefited those major companies.
Let's go back to Mr. Springman for a final comment. Mr. Springman, you can finish up on the comments that you were making about the broader ramifications of destabilization in Afghanistan. Also, if you'd like, you can add to what Mr. Funia has just mentioned about who benefited from the two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. Certainly, the Afghans didn't.
Oh, definitely they did not. Their country, which was never in great shape to begin with, has been totally destroyed. And Mr. Funia's comments on the vast sums of money that flowed into the pockets of the American military contractors is spot on. These are the people that benefited from the war, that will benefit from continuing destabilization in the region. The United States does not want to see Iran function as a healthy, stable government and with benefits for its peoples. The United States doesn't want to see a reunited and operable Iraq after 18 years of occupation, and the United States certainly doesn't want to see Syria functioning as it has previously before the American destruction 10 years ago. So I think that destabilization is to everyone's advantage if you live in the United States or in the NATO countries of Europe. So in the end, the whole benefit of this is more trouble, more problems, more dead people, more destroyed economies,
okay.
and the total dehousing, deculturalization, and destruction of entire nations.
All right, let's leave it there. That's all the time we have for the show. Allow me to thank my guest, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, joining us from Washington, and a special thanks to journalist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, joining us from L.A. Also, thanks to for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Making a biodegradable material strong enough to replace plastic is a tough task, but scientists are trying to do just that. We now present you an article written by Laura Patterson. The piece is titled, The Future of Plastic Alternatives. It comes from bacteria and goes back to bacteria. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. People think about plastic waste, they often think of the packaging that swaddles supermarket fruits and vegetables, shiny layers that are stripped away and thrown in the bin as soon as the produce is unloaded at home. It's a wasteful cycle that California-based company Appeal says it can help end. The firm has developed an edible, tasteless and invisible plant-based spray for fruits and vegetables that works as a barrier to keep oxygen out and moisture in, increasing shelf life without the need for single-use plastic. It's currently being sprayed onto cucumbers and avocados at retailers including Walmart. The CEO of Walmart, James Rogers, said, "We're showing that you can actually reimagine a food system that's not built on the foundation of single-use plastic." Appeal, which is valued at $2 billion as part of a wave of startups and scientific projects racing to develop materials that could help replace traditional single-use plastics. Their production methods and applications vary widely, but their stated aim is the same, to end the scourge of plastic waste. Since the 1950s, the world has produced an estimated 8.3 billion tons of plastics. Nearly two-thirds of which has ended up in landfill sites or leaching into soil, rivers and oceans. Choking wildlife, plastics are a driver of the climate crisis. The vast majority are made from fossil fuels, and if global production continues on current trends, plastics may account for about 20% of oil consumption by mid-century. The problem is that fossil-based plastics are not easy to replace. Plastic is a wonder material, cheap to produce, lightweight and incredibly durable. The latter is a great quality in use, but not when it ends up in a landfill site or the environment. Plastic can take centuries to degrade. Finding a material that is strong but can be essentially self-destruct when needed is incredibly tough. But plenty of scientists and companies are trying to do just that. Bioplastics have emerged as a popular alternative, even if they currently make up less than 1% of the market. Made from biosources such as sugarcane, algae, even banana waste and shellfish, many pitch themselves as eliminating the need for fossil fuels and also breaking down easily after use. Sarah Kakadelis, a researcher in plastic pollution at Imperial College, University of London, said these green claims do not always stand up to scrutiny. If the raw material is not sourced sustainably, bioplastics could end up increasing deforestation to clear land and competing with food production. They also do not always break down as easily as advertised, sometimes taking years. And others require industrial composting facilities, which can be scarce. Some companies say they have cracked these problems. The Dutch biochemicals company Avantium, which has partnered with brands such as Carlsberg, has developed a 100% plant-based plastic made from sugars that can be used for bottles and firms. The company says its plastic is 100% recyclable, has a significantly lower carbon footprint than fossil-based plastics, and is sourced from sustainably grown plants. If this plastic falls out of the recycling stream, trials have shown that it takes about a year to decompose in an industrial composer. According to initial results from a long-term study with the University of Amsterdam, left in the environment, the plastic starts to degrade after a year. Avantium plans to open its first plant in 2023 in the Netherlands and predicts its packaging will be in supermarkets in just 3 years' time. Other companies are developing plastics that avoid the need for crops altogether. In September, the British-based biotech startup Shellworks launched a plastic made from microbes found in many maritime and soil environments. These feed on carbon sources, building up a fat-like energy storage system. Shellworks co-founder Amir Afshar said, "When his fat is extracted, it behaves exactly like plastic. The difference is, when it returns to nature, the same bacteria see it as food and start to eat it." Afshar said it comes from bacteria and then goes back to bacteria. The company has signed deals with beauty companies to work on products such as tubes, bottles and compacts, which often end up in landfill sites. Co-founder Insia Jafarji said, "When people have finished with Shellworks products, they can be treated like food waste and composted with no special infrastructure needed." Other scientists are trying to turn plastic into a tool for tackling the climate crisis by making plastics from greenhouse gases. Kakadelis said, "One could see in the future capturing carbon dioxide from the air and then using that to produce plastic." Scientists at Rutgers University have developed technology that can turn water and carbon dioxide into precursors for various plastics, which they say could replace PET and polyester fiber, ubiquitous in the fashion industry. About 60% of materials made into clothing is from plastics. Anders Lawson, the chief executive officer of Renew Carbon Dioxide, the startup spun out of Rutgers University Research, said the method is essentially replicating nature's process for making oil and gas over millions of years, but doing so in a fraction of a second. The company hopes to harness the CO2 emitted from plastics as they decompose or are incinerated and use it to create new products. Renew Carbon Dioxide is building a pilot plant and expects to reach commercialization in 2025. Increasing consumer pushback on plastics has also led some companies to trial completely different materials. Mars and Unilever are experimenting with paper, which is widely recycled and less harmful than plastics if it ends up in the sea or at a landfill site. This summer, Coca-Cola begins testing a paper bottle in Hungary for one of its drinks, in partnership with Copenhagen-based startup Pabuco, which makes bottles from molded FSC-certified paper pulp. However, these bottles still have a plastic lid and are lined with a recycled PET plastic film, which keep the product from leaking or paper fibers from getting in. Pabuco's interim chief executive officer, Gitan Shield, said, "Our ultimate vision is to develop a fully bio-based paper bottle that can also be recyclable in the paper stream." Sander de Vruyt, who leads the New Plastics Economy Initiative at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, said the big question for these innovations are, where is the material sourced from and where does it end up? For example, paper isn't a sustainable packaging material if it contributes to deforestation or if the paper bottles and sweet wrappers don't make it into the recycling streams. It is also likely to take many years before these materials can scale up enough to make a dent in the 300 million tons of plastics recovered and produced every year. Mark Miodonic, Professor of Materials and Society at University College London, worries about the proliferation of materials being developed without enough thought about how they fit into existing waste systems. He said, mostly what we want to do is actually make plastics that are very durable and we want to keep them in the stream, so we want to recycle. Where he thinks biodegradability and compostability make sense are products such as caddy liners for food waste bins, tea bags. Why include the plastic that's going to last you 100 years into a tea bag? That's crazy. And hygiene products. Products with very short shelf lives could also suit compostable packaging. London-based Notpla makes plastic replacements from seaweed, a fast-growing carbon sequestering plant which breaks down anywhere within a few weeks. Co-founder Pierre Paslier said, "It's targeted at places where we pick something, we consume it, and it's over within minutes. And that's really where plastic is the worst material because it's going to be around forever." Notpla's edible Uho water bubbles were handed to runners at the 2019 London Marathon. It has also partnered with the delivery service Just Eat to provide compostable condiment sachets that can be put straight into the household food waste bins, and has developed a seaweed coating to replace the plastic lining on cardboard takeaway boxes. Sander de Vreugde said materials innovation is one part of the puzzle, but truly dealing with plastic waste requires a hierarchy of action. Eliminate as much plastic as possible, then use recycled plastic. Finally, where virgin plastic are still required, use renewable feedstocks. He added, it really needs to be done in that order. Miodonic said scientists, engineers and companies may be tempted to look at plastic and say, let's swap it for another thing, and that's now solved. But the truth is, you have to redesign the whole system if you're going to solve the problem.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.